ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever thought about the future? Not tomorrow or next year, but what life might look 60 years from now? It's actually really hard, and we know that because 60 years ago, we asked people to try.
You all commute daily and hourly so fast through space in your private flying saucers.
Global peace and international harmony will be completely attained by the year 2000.
So will our predictions be just as wrong? I'm Matt Bevan, and from If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a special series about why it's so hard to predict the future. It's available now on ABC Listen.
What a difference a few months and some key inflation figures make. The Reserve Bank of Australia Board has had its first monetary policy meeting for 2026 and has decided to lift interest rates by 25 basis points to 3.85%. So after the coalition split stole the spotlight at the beginning of this year and the beginning of this week, will this bring the focus back on the government and if the Treasurer is doing enough to manage the cost of living crisis? And Parliament is on, but looking a little different. Liberals sitting alone, Nationals sitting on the crossbench. Just how long will this arrangement remain? Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Tom Crowley.
And we're together in real life, IRL, and it's the first rates day of the year, first rate rise since 2023. This is quite a significant moment, I think. We're back up. Tom, what's your take?
We've gone into reverse, PK. Look, politically, and maybe we start there because this is a politics podcast, I don't think this is necessarily a calamity as far as the fight against inflation goes. I would actually say it's the first significant setback the RBA has had in a 3 years that's otherwise gone pretty smoothly. We got inflation all the way back down close to where the RBA wants it to be, and it's just stuck just above 3%. It may be that one rate hike, just a little course correction, we're still lower than where we were at the peak of all this. Perhaps that is enough just to sort of stem this little bit of damage we've seen in the last few months. It's really since June that things took a turn. Some speculation, maybe one more hike in May or something like that. But by no means is this giving up on the soft landing, giving up on the objective that Michelle Bullock has had for a while.
But we spent
so long, PK, you and I and everyone else on this podcast talking in the lead up to the election. When was the government going to get this rate relief, this tangible difference to people's cost of living? We know how important that was politically and for the people who are paying those mortgages, just as a sign that things are heading in the right direction, that direction of travel point. To have had three cuts, then a big pause, and now to turn around in the other direction, it lands like a thud. And mm-hmm. It's a really difficult one, and one that I think we can come to this. Jim Chalmers is already struggling to spin.
Yeah, okay, let's come to it now then, right? The spin. Politics podcast, the spin matters a lot. So just to give you the sort of brief overview of the parliamentary theatre today, it is a significant day, the first sitting, official sitting day. Yes, there were the 2 days we came back and they passed the hate laws, but the official start to the year and the sitting day, first question time of the full week, just to put that caveat around it. Coalition has not been able to resolve their split. We're going to get into that. And so they're sitting separately. It's really kind of embarrassing for them. And then flip the script. The rate rise happens. It happens during question time. You can see the look on the Treasurer's face. Not a happy face. He knows he has to get up and explain this to the Australian public. And his spin is, we know your pain. We know this is no good. And then this spin, the subtext being, it's not the government's fault. He actually said specifically, if you look at the monetary statement of the Reserve Bank Board, it says it's not about government spending. He wants the public to hear over and over again this message, Tom. It's not the government's fault. It's not the government's fault. It's not the government's fault. Is that going to wash? And is it true?
No, it's not going to fly because, like it or lump it, treasurers who enjoy basking in good news, and, you know, well, they should, and Jim Chalmers and Anthony Albanese, they very much enjoyed the rate cut coming just before the election. They did enjoy, you know, taking some share of the credit. Let's call a spade for the rate cuts in the last year or so. You got to wear the bad news as well. So is it the government's fault is a complicated question, and I think we've been having a discussion about this across the media that is not necessarily a very useful one. So one thing that you can say truthfully at the moment is that the biggest driver of heat in the economy is the private sector, mm-hmm. not the public sector. That wasn't true a year ago. A year ago, what we were seeing was the public sector leading the way. Government spending, particularly government jobs, growth in the care sector was the driving thing, really the beating pulse of the economy, the main cause, I suppose you would say, of inflation, but really just the main cause of economic activity at that time. The private sector's taken over that in the last few months or so. That's the basis on which Jim Chalmers says, well, this is not about us. This is about strength out there in the regular economy. And when you look at what the RBA has said today, they point to household spending and investment as the two main things that they're worried about, the two main justifications for this rate hike. But to step back a second, the government's actions affect the public sector and the private sector. So I don't think it's just as simple as saying, well, the government hasn't the public sector demand is not the strongest point here and therefore it's not our fault. Because when you look at a lot of things that the government does, cost of living measures, for example, what do? They put money into the pockets of people who live and work in the private sector.
Mm.
And even when you look at the spending of a teacher or a nurse or, you know, any public sector worker, their spending shows up in the household spending column. They spend it on private purposes. That's the private sector as well. So it's disingenuous to suggest that the government doesn't have anything to do with the private sector. Just as governments all the time, when the private sector is growing strong, when you're in the middle of a boom, a treasurer will say, how wonderful, we've got the economy growing. We've got jobs growing thanks to our responsible economic management. So again, governments are quite happy to take responsibility and take credit for strong performances in the private sector. I don't think you can distance yourself easily from the effect of government spending, particularly when some of these programs are really lining the pockets of people who are reasonably well off. So the two biggest growing government policies that have way exceeded their costs in the last little while, the government subsidy for electric vehicles and the government subsidy for home batteries. They're both to do with climate change. There's a reason the government wants to do them, but they're subsidizing the kinds of people who have enough money to buy electric vehicles and buy batteries for their solar panels. They're people who are reasonably well off. And when the government's subsidising that, they're putting effectively more money in the pockets of those people to continue spending. So none of that is to say that I think that this is the government's fault. Because
you're saying it's a much more complex story and that the Treasurer's kind of seizing on a lack of a sentence that blames the government in the statement is overreach.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the government has its part to play in this. It's not the whole problem. But I think crucially, when you look forward to the budget and to the actions the government could take next, there are plenty of things within the government's power to constrain spending, or at least to stop piling more money into people's pockets for them to spend. There are things the government can do from here to make the Reserve Bank government's job easier and to make it, to help in the fight against inflation. And I think that's where the conversation needs to go.
Okay, so that's where we'll need to go. So the Treasurer will be, you know, wall to wall trying to spin the government side of this because, you know, he knows and the government knows that, yeah, there can be a lot of shenanigans on the coalition side, and there are, but ultimately people do notice when they have to pay more on their mortgage and they have less money to spend on, I don't know, their kids' sport or the groceries, which we know are very expensive, right? Like, that is a real thing that's about to happen to people, and that's going to annoy people. I'd be surprised if it didn't, Tom, because I can tell you the people in my life find that annoying. So that's going to happen, bake it in, and always the government gets the backlash because yeah, they're in charge. Susan Lee got given a bit of a sort of boost. You could see it in question time when she finally could hammer this issue. But back to the politics part of this podcast, because it's a big part of the podcast. I mean, I sat there watching that question time. I went in. I'll give people a bit of a peek behind the curtain. I sit in the same spot I've sat, I think, for 24 years when I come here, right in the centre of between the opposition leader and the prime minister, and watch the dynamics. And I just don't think the government looked as stressed as it could have looked, because there were gags about the coalition being sitting apart, like all of that. So in some ways, all of the shenanigans, which we'll get to in the coalition, have really given the government an easier ride today than you would expect.
Yeah, and I think that that's something people on the coalition side have been aware of as well. some of the conversations last week between Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie, we understand this issue came up, that when they were discussing whether this was a good time to have a leadership spill. I mean, today is the day when it might have happened, had it happened in the Liberal Party room that was held this morning. And what a colossal distraction that would have been if there was a new Liberal leader in question time, or if there had been some sort of spill and broader chaos, how much that would have distracted from, you know, a day that can't be spun as anything other than bad news for the government. And I think, you know, privately on the Labor side as well, they are breathing a sigh of relief that it's happening now while there is all this chaos on the other side. And so I think, you know, in the longer run, it's just going to depend what happens next.
Yes.
I mean,
so what's going to happen next? Okay, you said, should we expect, you think, another rate rise? I mean, what are the markets saying? What are the experts saying? Not that they always get it right, of course, but there is an expectation. And I think that it's more, it's always the cumulative nature, isn't it, that creates sort of anxiety. That's the problem, isn't it?
Yes. And look, we should timestamp this. We're recording before Governor Michelle Bullock has gotten up, and no doubt she will be asked about the prospect of further rate hikes, and I'm sure, as usual, she will be ambiguous, but...
Oh, she'll column A, column B. She'll give you both options.
Right. But at least at this stage, there is an expectation that, for now, one more rate hike could be possible, and we're in a wait-and-see moment, that we haven't done enough yet on the fight against inflation. That's the Reserve Bank's view, and we will need to now think of ourselves for the next little while in a period where we're still in inflation busting mode. I think the question of what happens next, look, it comes back to the fact that there's no strong heartbeat that is propelling our economy forward. There's no what you might call vibrancy or dynamism, or the word I'm trying not to use, productivity growth. There is no underlying impetus, and there hasn't been for some time in Australia and in many rich countries, that can sustain growth, higher standard of living, strong jobs market, strong wages growth, without the risk of some inflation. Mm. This is the thing that makes everyone hate economists, because it's such a frustrating trade-off that economists are insistent on. And
they're insistent on because our economy is built in that way. So, you know, unless you radically reimagine it, and that's a whole other debate on the left and the right, by the way, but if you stick to this model, that's how it works.
And
that's the grand bargain.
This is the story of history. This is the story that is backed up with, you know, reams of empirical data. You can argue about exactly where the trade-off sits and how, you know, exactly where you can get it to. But it is, you know, an article of faith, really, and we've seen it time and time again, that unless you can have some, you know, maybe it's a mining boom, maybe today it's artificial intelligence, you know, go all the way back to when it was the steam engine. Unless there is something new that is expanding the frontiers of what a country and its economy can produce, well, then any growth in economic activity, if it's just coming out of thin air, that's when it tends to be inflationary. And Australia has, you know, got a pretty good balance, and has had a pretty good balance for the last couple of years, where we've had wages growing at a healthy clip. We've had a low unemployment rate that's actually really, really, really low by historical standards, the kind of low we haven't seen in 50 years. And inflation's been heading in the right direction. That's what Jim Chalmers has been calling this wonderful trifecta. And it is true. We have actually felt like we're on the cusp of this pretty nice combination of these things that economists tell us intention.
Cusp is the key word, though, right? We have not landed the soft landing.
We haven't. And I think one of the most significant things that happened, that the shift in the RBA's language last year, was around mid-year when they shifted their short-term assumption on productivity, and they said, look, we're just not seeing that's the kind of magic ingredient that would allow this lovely trifecta to continue where it is. And if we don't get it, it's not to say that there needs to be some massive spike in unemployment or anything like that, but in order to get inflation back to between 2 and 3%, we may need unemployment to get a little higher. We may need household spending to be constrained a little more. We may need to be in that inflation fighting environment for just a little bit longer. And so that makes the question for government really urgent about what can you do to stimulate that productivity growth what can you do to get a little bit of that pulse going back? And so everything across government, the future made in Australia, the critical minerals stuff with the United States, so many different areas, artificial intelligence, everywhere the government's looking for that bright spot that's going to explain the next few years of growth. But in the meantime, and this is another area where the government's role is a significant one, in the meantime, actually, a lot of the jobs growth we've seen in the last 2 or 3 years has been in the care sector. A lot of the wages growth as well has been in the care sector. That plays a really important role in our society that we recognise, but it's not a sector that we look to grow productivity. And so if you're going to sustain that expansion in the care sector, again, it makes it even more urgent to find that lifeblood, mm-hmm. find that pulse that can drive the economy forward. That's the missing element that now I think becomes more urgent for the government and that will determine whether this continues to be a thorn in their side.
So a big day for the many people who do have mortgages, of course, across the country. And I think many people will be feeling a little bit nervous as they make some financial plans and what they can come cut back on with huge political ramifications. You know, watch the space of the third party vote that we've been seeing, can I say, because I think as economic grievances rise, you see that disgruntled parking with groups like One Nation. I think it's all very linked, my friends. But I want to change the conversation, if I can, to what we've been seeing in the coalition. Here we go. Nationals MPs who were sacked for breaching the shadow cabinet solidarity would be benched for 6 months under this new plan that Susan Lee came up with and took to the Nationals leader, David Littleproud. So they've been having meetings overnight. We're recording this on a Tuesday, trying to work out whether they can get back together. My read from some sources is that, and I quote, hard no from the Nationals on this benching for 6 months. And so here we are in a situation where the Nationals are sort of playing hardball. They sat on their own in question time, which is a little bit embarrassing. The government putting them in certain positions. You'll see the pictures where, you know, we've got the Nationals leader on the second row. Looked really weird, not usual. And they don't want to give in to the Liberals' demands, but Susan Lee's trying to find a way through. What's this all about?
I'm not surprised it's a hard no from the Nats because, you know, as much as they're saying they're open to rejoining the coalition, not for a moment have really any of them flinched for even the slightest second in acknowledging that they did anything wrong to precipitate this split. And that's the thing that just hasn't shifted. So you do have, you know, Susan Lee making this offer and sort of saying, oh, you know, maybe I can let it slide if we just agree to, you know, wind it down to a 6 month penalty rather than a permanent penalty. But the Nats haven't budged at all. David Littleproud and every single other person from across his party who has spoken have said, well, we had a party room. We made this decision. The senators were acting in accordance with our wishes. We are the Nationals Party. We cannot accept any of your arguments about cabinet solidarity. And what you heard from Kevin Hogan, who walked straight out of the meeting last night and on to 7:30, he was basically saying, look, there remains a difference of opinion about exactly how those events played out and who was at fault. And so I'm not actually seeing any substantive movement on the cause of the argument from the Nats. And so that puts Susan Lee in this position where either she's got to blink to get them back together or she has to stand her ground, and neither of those look great for her leadership. It's the same position she was in 2 weeks ago because there doesn't seem to be any pressure on the Nats to do the same. Dan Tehan on the Liberal side has been out yesterday saying, let's have no red lines. Let's see if we can just put the events of the last couple of weeks behind us. Nobody in the Nats is sounding as conciliatory on that.
Okay, no, but they also want not to be basically bound by this shadow cabinet comfort. Can you just explain this, like what that even means? Why are they expecting to freelance on things?
They point to a couple of sort of precedents in history where the Nationals have gone separate ways, and it just does seem to have been a total mess in the days leading up to this hate law, where you had a shadow cabinet on Sunday and then you didn't have one again, and so some confusion about exactly what was a decision and what wasn't. But yes, you know, essentially the Nats argument, and again, Dan Tehan backed this up yesterday and essentially endorsed it, was that – given the situation and given how bad things are for the coalition, they should be given some, I think Dantine used the word nuance into the age-old idea of cabinet solidarity. It's actually a pretty radical proposition that they're putting to Susan Lee, that they're essentially, and people within her own party are now essentially demanding that she accept. I don't see how it could work practically at all for those three Nats to just sit out for 6 months. For one thing, either you'll have no Nats shadow ministers at all in the Senate, or you'll have Matt Canavan in the shadow cabinet, hardly a figure that's going to help bridge the gap between the Nats and the Liberal Party, given the positions that he takes. So I just feel like that is untenable. Maybe there will be some sort of resolution coming here, but I'm not convinced that last night's meeting actually got things any closer.
No, and now it's started, the separation on visual display. Don't think this is not a big deal, guys. Like, these parties have been in coalition for an incredibly long period of time. Even the last breakup, you know, just after the last federal election was a brief one. They got back together much, you know, you didn't see it played out in the parliament like this. So once it starts, hard to peel it back. And there is a split even inside the Liberals about how far or what they offer. Of course, the moderates are really thumping, you know, their chests, so to speak, and saying, well, actually, maybe we should be divorced for, you know, separated for a longer period because we want to assert ourselves. Andrew Bragg making that point, you know, like really try and recapture the metropolitan areas through being a very Liberal brand. Not everyone agrees with that, though. Some think that that's really risky, but now we're in territory where it started, hard to pull back, right?
And Susan Lee has once again put a timer on her own decision, because by the end of the week, she said if this isn't resolved, she's going to make more permanent arrangements for a Liberal-only shadow cabinet, and that's a decision to allocate more staffing, higher salaries to Liberals. It makes it all that much harder to undo.
It really does. And so, last point on the podcast. Okay, we're at Tuesday afternoon. Susan Lee's still the leader of the Liberal Party and official opposition, even if they're not in coalition anymore. They obviously decided, and we knew this, we foreshadowed this, that they weren't going to roll her on Rates Day. That means, my friends, watch that space tomorrow and the next day and the day after, because I don't know how long this reprieve will last. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think if opinion polls keep showing One Nation pulling ahead of the Liberal Party and Pauline Hanson pulling well ahead of Susan Lee as preferred Prime Minister, I mean, that will keep creating its own pressure on Lee's leadership.
That's absolutely right. And so watch that space. Maybe just a short reprieve for Susan Lee, although she was in that special chair opposite the Prime Minister in question time. That's it for Politics Now today. Tomorrow, Raph Epstein will join me on the pod. And don't worry, you'll also get your weekly dose of David Spears. He'll join Fran and I on the Party Room on Thursday. You can also send your questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au and we will endeavour to answer them. See you later.